Hello, my name is Dave and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of our group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think that it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have a list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Lisa will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Devra will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Devra. I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Dennis will read the traditions.
Thank you. I'm Dennis Caron. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group would never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
4 of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Colby C.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kobe, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Okay. You put that sign down. As I said, my name is Kobe, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 3rd of 2000. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is the beautiful Faye. I would like to thank Jen for asking me to speak. It has really helped my sobriety, and I'm very fortunate to be sober and to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd also like to thank the lovely ladies of the Rowdy Crow, of the Rowdy Row over there. Thank you very much. You definitely welcomed me when I came back to New York several months ago, and you kept me smiling, laughing, and I really appreciate it. I love you very much, and I'm looking forward to many more years of sitting with you on the Rowdy Row. Having said that, I would actually like to welcome everybody here. If you're just counting days, welcome. If you are still drinking today and found it necessary to pick up a drink or drug today, welcome. You're in the right place, and we do love you. If you're just coming back, welcome. I was told not to curse, and I'm going to do my best. I was told to focus on alcohol and not drugs, and I'm going to do my best. What I say is a reflection of me and my experience being an alcoholic out there, having had one of several spiritual experiences that led me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then living a life as a sober woman since 2000. It is not necessarily a reflection of AA, so if there's anything that I say that you disagree with, please keep coming back. I'm sure you'll find many more speakers who could carry the message better than me, but just for today, I didn't find it necessary to pick up, and for someone like me, that's a total success. When asked to speak, the first thing that came to mind is that alcoholism is a medical condition. It is not a moral issue. And for me, that's really important. And while reading the first 164 pages recently of the big book, I realized that our big book opens up with the doctor's opinion, not the high school counselor's opinion, not the ABC clerk's opinion, not the bartender's opinion, because trust me, they all had opinions of me, not the banker's opinion or the one-night stand opinion or the I thought you were the one opinion, not the therapist's opinion, because I went to many of them before I came into AA, not the preacher's opinion, they certainly had one of me and my lifestyle as well, not the self-help guru's opinion, because I bought all their books, not the local sheriff's opinion or the judge's opinion, not the state hospital psychiatric warden's opinion, or my friends and family's opinion, thank God, but it actually opens with the doctor's opinion. And again, alcoholism is a medical condition. It is not a moral issue. And it talks about in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that it's a twofold disease. There's the mental obsession, and then there's also the physical allergy. And for me, it's really important to know that, and I did not know that alcoholism was a medical condition until I came into the rooms of AA, and I actually read the big book, and I listened to the Joe and Charlie tapes, and it broke it down for me. And the reason why it was important to me is that it took away some of the shame and guilt of who I was and what I did, sometimes when I was drunk, sometimes when I was sober. Now, if you've never had a sponsor kind enough to make you look up every word in the first 164 pages in the dictionary, it's a gift, but I've had one of those. And so, in case you don't know what obsession is an idea or a desire that continuously troubles or worries the mind. And in chapter 3, it was broken down for me what exactly that idea or desire that troubles my mind is, and it's this. The idea that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drink is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And for those taking my inventory that I'm reading from notes, it's okay. Trust me, I'm taking my own inventory as I speak. I have a built-in forgetter. So, and for me, you know, bringing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and not just what happened to me is most important. So if you'll forgive my imperfection, I would greatly appreciate it. So as far as the controlling and enjoying my drink, it's very true. That was the great obsession. There were definitely times when I drank that I could control my drinking. There was definitely times when I drank that I really enjoyed my drinking. But when I controlled my drink, I never enjoyed it. And when I enjoyed my drink, I certainly never tried to control it. So my great obsession as an alcoholic is to control and enjoy. And that just wasn't possible. So for me, like, the great obsession, what's most important in that is the somehow and someday. Because I spent the next 16 years trying to make that happen, control and enjoy it. And these were some of the somehows. And again, because I was told to or suggested to look up the word somehow. Somehow means the idea, or excuse me, somehow simply means that in some way not specified or apparent or known. So I just went over a list. I wrote down, because I have a built-in forgetter and I was drunk most of the time, the many ways that were unknown or unapparent about how I would try to drink. At age 8, I stole my first beer from my grandmother's kitchen cabinet. Between the ages of 8 and 10, I stole vodka from my parents' liquor cabinet. And so as not to get caught and had the liquor cabinet locked, I would fill the bottles of vodka with water. Around the age of 12, I hung out in front of convenience stores and begged strangers to buy me beer. I distracted store clerks while friends stuffed stolen beers down their pants. I sneaked sips of alcohol from discarded cups or abandoned glasses at my parents' parties. I actually went through garbage bags and pulled out any sort of alcoholic can or bottle I could find and would drink anything that was left over. I would sneak out of my bedroom window to get to my stash of alcohol and to drink it. I would hide bottles of alcohol in the woods behind my house. At the age of 14, I would meet men 18 years and older at restaurants who could actually buy me drinks in the restaurants and malls before I would have my parents pick me up. I got boys and men to mail bottles of vodka, Wild Turkey, and Jack Daniels to my boarding school, to my mailbox at boarding school. Once there, I would hide my vodka in those little bubble bottles because our rooms would get inspected. And I didn't care if they took anything else, but they I was not going to have them take my alcohol, so I would find places to hide it. At the age of 15, my best friend and I drugged her parents with an entire box of sleeping pills so that we could drink alcohol on a New Year's Eve. When our alcohol supply ran out, we called a cab, left all of our friends at the house, her mother, her father, everything, to go to a frat party and drink. I learned how to laminate a fake college ID so that I could drink. At the age of 15, I spent weekends at frat parties, at frat houses, so I could drink all weekend long the way I wanted to drink. I lied to bouncers and maitre d's, telling them that I was meeting a friend inside so I could get past the bouncer. Once inside, I would change clothes into completely inappropriate clothes, put on makeup, and take a seat at the bar so I could drink. I made very inappropriate innuendos with bartenders and businessmen to get them to buy me alcohol at restaurants, bars, or clubs. I would vomit, sometimes on purpose, sometimes not, sometimes in appropriate places, sometimes in very inappropriate places, so that I could keep drinking more alcohol. I stole wine. I would steal wine and then walk house to house at a ski resort so that I could find a party with more wine and alcohol in it, you know, and the list goes on. What happened to me at the age of 26 is that, and this gets to the allergy of it as well, the allergy is that once I pick up my first drink, I can't stop. And on August 2nd of 2000, my daily routine was a couple of bottles of wine during the day while I was at work, catch the subway home, get a few margaritas, buy a couple of bottles of champagne, and in the night blacked out, passed out, and that was a wonderful day. August 2nd, 2000, I told myself I was just going to have one drink. And so, I told myself I wasn't going to drink at all at work, and I didn't. 5 o'clock came, I wanted to celebrate, so I decided that I was going to go next door and get one glass of champagne. I went there, and after the second glass of champagne, I blacked out, and I came to in several different places in several different locations around New York. And the next day, I woke up, and it was too much. And I realized that I thought to myself, I think I have a problem. And the reason why I say that is because when I was 17, I met a gentleman who had a year and a half sober. And I asked him, how do you know that you're an alcoholic? And thank God, the only thing he said to me was, if you think you have a problem, then you probably do. And it's just that simple. So if there's anybody here drinking or non-drinking, if you think you have a problem with alcohol, you probably do. Please keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. My first meeting I walked into for myself was the Atlanta Group Beginners Meeting on Thursday nights. I believe it was on Fifth Avenue at that time. And thank God, because of this group, because of all of AA, because of all of you, I haven't had to pick up a drink since then. What is like now? You know, as if it's not enough, I don't have to drink today. But I'm happy, joyous, and free. Just got fired on Thursday. I'm happy, joyous, and free. Don't have a penny to my name. Happy, joyous, and free. I got the goodbye, so this is really goodbye. But please come and talk to me afterwards. If you're a newcomer, please come say hi to me. And please keep coming back because AA does work, thank God. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Max.
Hey, how are you? I'm Max. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 21st, 2007. So it gives me a little over a year. And a year ago, it was a disaster. So, I mean, for me to be here today talking about sobriety is something that I really didn't think would ever happen. For me, drinking started probably when I was about 13 years old. I was uncomfortable always as a child. My life full of fear. I was meeting some girls at a party, and I didn't feel comfortable, so I had a few drinks because I saw everybody in my family do that, and it worked. So I had the best time I can remember. I danced, which I don't do. I laughed. I had fun. And then every day for the rest of my life, I thought maybe if I get a little bit more, I'll have an even better time. And that didn't work. I'll fast forward because I really want to concentrate on, there was a period when I stopped drinking altogether without the help of AA, and that was a disaster. Up until, most through my life, I drank, I got in trouble, I got in fights. They weren't really fights, I got beat up. I got thrown out of everywhere I went, kicked out of fraternities, kicked out of bars. It was a disaster. So I got married. And she was great, and she liked to fix people, and I needed fixing. But the poor thing only lasted about 3 years. And she left, and when she left, she said, "You're an alcoholic." And I said, "Well, I'll show you. I won't drink anymore." She left anyway, but... I hate to say stayed sober. I didn't stay sober. I was dry for about 4 years, and it was miserable. Alcohol provided me with everything I needed at the time. I had no social skills. I had no ability to cope with anything. Alcohol gave me that freedom to not have to worry about it. I guess in this program, it's always like you think about today. For me, when I was drinking, it was like, I'll worry about it tomorrow. And my whole life was like, next to tomorrow, I'll do it tomorrow. But then after she left, and I was not drinking, I met somebody eventually, much younger, with more friends. And we'd been out a while, and she said, that's strange that you don't drink. And then I could feel it in the back of my head, like, I think she's going to ask me if I want to drink. And I hoped and I hoped, and then finally she did. And I tried to explain that this was going to be a complete disaster. But I hoped that she wouldn't agree, and she didn't. So I had a drink, and I had another drink. And after 4 years of not having a single drop of alcohol, I had 10 drinks. And the next day I had 10 drinks. I picked up new things that I had never really been involved with before. And within 2 months, I was right back Actually, I was further along than I was before I had 4 years. I mean, it was a disaster. I didn't know what happened. I mean, it happened so fast. It was like after two months of this, I tried to stop, and I couldn't. I mean, it's almost like if I was in a bad dream, and I tried to wake up, and I couldn't, and it just kept getting worse and worse. I mean, there's that dude with the saw chasing you down. You know, it was like, it was horrible. 2.5 years of every day waking up, actually, if I went to sleep, waking up, knowing that I had no chance of getting out of this mess on my own. And, you know, I like doing things on my own. I just was used to doing things that way. So work became a disaster. She was scared to death. Her friends were scared to death. People didn't like the way I drank. I mean, and I remembered that from, it made people nervous, you know. It wasn't so much drinking as it was pouring things into my body. And I didn't want to stop. I couldn't wait to get more and more in. I mean, and I didn't pass out. You'd have to knock me out to get me to stop. So, you know, essentially what happened to me was after this for 2.5 years and running into my friends that knew me as the guy that stopped drinking, I couldn't hang out with them anymore because I was so embarrassed that all of a sudden, like, I mean, someone that seemed to have, you know, their life, getting their life back on track, and it just became a lie. So then I started, you know, drinking and using at home by myself, and that's when the fun really started. I mean, I wouldn't leave my house for days or for weeks. Work was, you know, if I got to it. I don't really have a job that works that way. I don't know if anybody does, but so finally, what happened, I guess, for me was a guy at work said, "I think you might need to go away for a little while," you know, and I didn't want to. But, I mean, I was standing there in front of him, reeked of booze, my nose is bleeding, and I'm carrying on a conversation with him, saying, like, no, I think I'm going to be okay. And so I went to rehab. I went a couple times. And when I came back, I got some of the tools that they taught me. And the one thing that I had a big issue with was the higher power thing. I said, well, I think I could do everything. The higher power thing, I'm not so sure he and I get along. So, you know, in the book it talks about half measures avail us nothing, and it's true. I did every part of the program except that. And within 3 weeks, I was back out again. For me, it just... I came back in and out and in and out, and it just, something was missing, and I didn't know what it was. I knew what it was. I didn't want to admit what it was. So my sponsor's Patrick, by the way, Patrick K. So I dragged myself to this meeting, and I think I had about an hour of not drinking. And he saw me, and I think I just remember the look on his face, like, you know, oh, my God. But he knew that look. I mean, and he told me he had that look when he came in. And that was the first time I'd heard that. Instead of like a guy that I work with looking at me and saying, like, you know, how, you just spent 2 months at rehab. How can you come back and start using again? Are you a monster? And, you know, I'm not a monster, but it takes another alcoholic to realize that. You know, I have a sickness, an illness, a disease. And he understood that. And he asked me if I had a sponsor. And I said, no. And he said, now you do. And he said, well, we need to go to meetings. We need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, I'll do that. It's like the guy who didn't like to say yes to anything was all of a sudden like, yes, please. I mean, I finally had that, you know, gift of desperation. You know, my program wasn't working. I was dying. I could feel it. I was dying. So we did that. I mean, he introduced me to Atlantic Group, which saved my life, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to Pockets of Enthusiasm, which I laughed and made fun of, and then I really had a fantastic time. Because that's the way I am. I like to hate things and make fun of things. And then when I go, I'm like, yeah, it's like my whole sobriety is like that. It's like I'm negative until I do something, and then I actually like it. And that's what I'm working on today. I mean, I only have a year. I'm not trying to change my entire life right away. I'm taking small steps. You know, I have a lot of work. But my life is, I mean, it's remarkably different. It's so much better. I mean, I do have a higher power in my life because I know that, you know, the obsession that Kobe talked about, willpower just, you know, I can pretty much willpower anything else in my life. But willpower with my disease does not work. I mean, I beat my head against the wall for 2.5 years and tried every day to get one day clean, and I couldn't do it. You know, and then I came to understand that it was because, you know, the obsession can't be lifted by anything human. So thank you so much. It's been great, and I love the Atlantic Group, and thank you.
And our main speaker tonight is Barbara.
Hi, everyone. My name is Barbara, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And it's great to be here. Even though I'm a little nervous, it's really, really good to be here. I came to this group about a month ago just to check it out. My nephew, who has 60 days today. One day at a time. I came to check it out with him because Bob had asked me to speak, and I really wanted to see what kind of format you did here. And I'll tell you, I left here, and I was so excited about him being a member of this group. You have a great group. Really, if I lived in New York, I'd be a member of this group. That's how good it is. But I live in Northern Westchester, so it would be, you know, a little bit of a distance for me. But we all are willing to go to any lengths. The enthusiasm, the activeness, the greeters, you know, I mean, you do everything here. And it's the kind of group I got sober in. It's what helped me to get sober because there were so many women who had so much time and, you know, they had a peace and a serenity in their life and they were excited about living. And I wanted what those women had. I wanted it. And so I kept going back. I also was really blessed when I got sober. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think I was a couple years sober before I even realized it. You know, some are more mocus than others. You know, it took me a long time to come to, but I realized that my aunt was probably about 25 years sober at the time. And she started to come to my anniversaries, and I started to fly down to Florida in February and March to spend time with her. I thought her spirituality would rub off on me, you know, and I was really blessed with that gift of having a family member, you know, who really loved and cared for me to be sober and to be able to pass that on to me. And I am so blessed to be able to pass it on to David and have all of you pass it on. I mean, that's the heartbeat of this program, and hopefully someday he will in turn be able to pass it on to another. Because that's what this whole fellowship is about. You know, we give it away to keep it. And now I have to tell you a little bit about me, which for most alcoholics isn't really difficult, but, you know, I like really talking about recovery a lot more than I do a drunkalog. I'm not a very exciting... my alcoholism, you know, really didn't lead me down roads of excitement. It really was sadness and emptiness and drama and pain. You know, that's really what brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt dead on the inside. I felt empty on the inside. I felt like, you know, I lived with a guy before I came in here, and he used to always say to me, all the lights are on, Barbara, but nobody is home. And that's really who I was. I was this empty shell walking through life, and I became whoever you were. You know, I just kind of attached myself to you, and I was a chameleon, you know. But I have to tell you, in hindsight, and we only have hindsight once we walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and we begin this journey of sobriety, we're given this gift, this miracle. In hindsight, I can stand up here today and I can tell you that I was born an alcoholic. There is not a question in my mind that I had this disease well before a drink ever became a part of my life. You know, drinking is a symptom of alcoholism. You know, I think Kobe talked about it. You know, it's a threefold disease. It's physical, mental, and spiritual. And, you know, I had this disease well before a drink ever became a part of my life. We hear people in meetings all the time talking about how they felt less than, how they never felt good enough, how they never felt pretty enough, they weren't smart enough, they didn't measure up. You know, they never fit in. I truly was the black sheep in my family. You know, I had a sister who happens to be here tonight, and she didn't like me very much when I drank, and I hated her. You know, I truly, she was just too perfect for me. You know, Donna's her name, Donna the Prima Donna, I used to sing all the time, you know, because she was perfect. I mean, you know, she dated the right guys in high school, always the jocks, always the big successful names, you know, in the paper. She went to school at, you know, college in Boston. She always looked right. She always acted right. She, you know, had straight A grades, and, you know, then came me. And I just was not a member of that family. I really wasn't. I just, you know, it's funny. I think of, you know, I used to watch, I love Christmas. My father loved Christmas. I'll tell you about that later. But I used to watch, you know, Rudolph all the time. And I was Rudolph. You know, I was the misfit, you know, who belonged on that little island way out there because I just never fit in. You know, you hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about how when they picked up a drink, it was like, you know, everything came together, everything worked. They felt like they finally were at least equal with the rest of the world. They measured up, they fit in. You know, that never happened for me. You know, I drank for oblivion. I drank for blackout. I drank for, I don't want to remember how I felt. You know, I truly, that's why I drank. I drank because I didn't like the way I felt. And that's what drinking did for me. It allowed me not to feel, you know, and for 21 years, I didn't cry. You know, I didn't start to feel until I came alive in Alcoholics Anonymous because of you, because you held my hand and you walked me through the steps and you showed me how to live sober without a drink, a day at a time. I mean, what a concept, a day at a time. I never lived in the moment. I lived in yesterday, regretting it. I lived in tomorrow, forgetting about it, worrying about it. I didn't know how to live in now. You know, I didn't know how to live, period. And I when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I really, for the first time, and this is the God's honest truth, for the first time in my life, I felt at home. You know, I felt people, I heard people talk about me. And I wondered, you know, did they talk to my mother? Did they talk to the guy I'm living with? Did they get on the phone with my sister? How do they know about me? How do they know all this stuff? You know, I just didn't get it. It was kind of like when I was little and I used to watch TV, and I didn't know how all the little people got inside the TV. You know, I just could never figure that out. And I could never figure out how they knew about me when I came in here. You know, it's there was just something going on, and of course, I just didn't know what it was. But anyway, I at the age of 4, I had a very, very traumatic time. I had an eye operation right here at Columbia Presbyterian, and it was a life-changing event because I carried it with me well into sobriety. Seriously, it was... this is alcoholism at its best. Age 4, and the anesthesia wasn't enough. I needed more. I needed more twice. Woke up in the elevator and woke up in the operating room. And I never knew that until I got sober and my 25-year-old sober aunt told me, you know, that's alcoholism, Barbara. You know, I always needed more. I always wanted more. I could drink any one of you under the table, you know, like I could drink. And I, you know, it took me out of me. I loved it. But at the age 4, I was very brave. You know, for a little 4-year-old girl, I was terrified, but I was so brave. I cry a lot when I share, you know, and there was a man, Bob Stofko, when I got sober, who used to tell me, Barbara, don't lose it. It's gratitude. Hang on to it. It'll keep you sober. So I've cried for 26 years in these rooms, and you know what? I'm not embarrassed about it anymore. I get laughed at and, you know, made fun of, you know, but people know I'm grateful. You know, so if I cry, I cry, and that's okay with me because, again, I didn't feel for 21 years. You know, and sobriety has now allowed me to feel, and that is such a good thing. So anyway, at the age of 4, I had this operation, and it was horrible. I don't want to dwell on it, but I woke up during it, as I told you, and then in the middle of the night, back then they wouldn't let your parents stay with you. You know, and I woke up screaming in the middle of the night for my mother, and the nurse came and told me if I didn't shut up, the cops would come, they would take me away, they would lock me up, and, you know, I just, oh, I mean, 4 years old, screaming for my mother. My mother and I were deprived of really a mother and daughter relationship until I got sober because of that. I never, ever, ever forgave her for leaving me alone. I just never forgave her. And it took me a long time to come to terms with that. It took me a long time in sobriety to come to terms with a lot of things, all the pain that I caused. My parents, you know, we always hurt the ones that love us the most. You know, my parents would, you know, I look at myself a lot like Humpty Dumpty, you know, and I would fall off the wall and they'd pick me up and they'd put me back together again. You know, otherwise I'd be in Bedford Prison for sure. You know, I just happened to have a family who stood by me, who loved me, and who took care of me. You know, they'd come to Boston when they got a call and they were told, you know, your daughter's doing drugs. My father would just show up out of nowhere. And I would be like, oh, God, I can't even get away from him up here. You know, he's got to follow me. I just, you know, I had a lot of pain when I got sober for the pain that I caused others. And then as my disease progressed, before the drink ever even came into my hand, I remember feeling like I just didn't fit in and I didn't measure up when I received my first Holy Communion, you know. And then when I was 8, I remember, you know, there's so much in between, but I'm just trying to bring it into these specifics, you know, alcoholism, symptoms of. And I became a bookworm. I lived in books. I hated my life. I lived in books. You know, that's when all the walls went up. You know, and the fantasy began. You know, I tell my mother things that happened to me today when I was younger, and she tells me, Barbara, they never happened. You know, and I just had the wildest imagination. And, you know, that's alcoholism, and I know it. You know, it fires it up for us. And, you know, we don't like the life we're living, so we create one of our own. Forget about this virtual reality. We had it way back when. You know, it's not new. I mean, I was doing that then. You know, had I patented it, been smart enough, I'd probably be a billionaire today. But that was how I lived, you know. And I picked up my first drink probably at the age of 16 or 17 years old. I was a late bloomer, and I drank for 10 years. And I am not big on drunkologues. I'm really not. And I'm not proud of anything I'm going to share with you tonight. I was raised in a Catholic family. I went to Catholic school. I went to church on Sunday. And the minute I picked up a drink, everything I learned was lost. All my morals went out the window. Everything. The minute I drank, you know, I could not predict my behavior. You know, all bets were off. I tell you, I'll be home at 1 o'clock in the morning. I came home a week later. You know, I just was so unpredictable. And I was a perfectionist, which is another symptom of alcoholism, in case you didn't know. You know, I mean, I used to measure my hangers in my closet and pin down my bedspread. So I would go out with this bright, fresh, ivory girl, you know, look, you know, and there couldn't be a wrinkle on me or hair out of place, you know. And the minute I picked up a drink, you know, I'd be rolling in the mud, you know, and it wouldn't matter. It just didn't matter. I would wake up with men I never even met before, didn't know who they were, in places I'd never been, you know, and I'm not proud of that. But that's what my disease did. You know, I was looking, I thought love was the answer, you know. I was kind of a late 60s, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I really thought that, you know, a man would fix me, you know, would make me better, would make me whole. You know, I was Watkins Glen, you know, I was a Grateful Dead, I was a deadhead, I moved out to California to meet Jerry Garcia, I lived with a jazz guitarist, you know, I was like so into music, and, you know, it was like, you know, la-di-da, you know, I just hiking up in the mountains of Berkeley out in California and loving every minute of it, you know. We laugh in Alcoholics Anonymous because we share all these experiences and memories that we've had. And we say what a good time we had, but we can't remember them, you know. I was in a blackout, but I had a great time. I got to tell you, you have no idea what you missed last night. You know, and I mean, that's how my life was. I literally was in and out of states. I went from New York to Boston, from Boston to New York, to California, to Texas. But I always brought Barbara with me wherever I went. So life never got better, you know. But I thought what I was doing was normal. I truly did. And the reason I did was because I gravitated toward my own kind. I gravitated toward people that drugged and drank. That's a good one, huh? That drug and drank the way I did. You know, so I would feel normal. So I would feel like I wasn't, you know, different. So I would feel like I fit in. I'll tell you about my last drink. I don't know how much time it is. I haven't seen a sign yet. Are you sleeping on the job? Okay. I had my last drink, and it was uneventful. You know, it truly was uneventful, as it is for a lot of us. You know, no fireworks, which I love today. No fireworks went off. You know, I was at work. I picked up a drink during lunch, and I never went back. You know, I was in and out of jobs. I can't even tell you. I can't even count on my hands and toes how many jobs I had. I mean, and I always got a better one. I mean, my father used to say to me, he used to put his hand on my shoulder, and he would say to me, Barbara, I don't know what it is about you, but God has his hand on your shoulder. Well, little did he know, you know, he really had his hand on my shoulder. But I was, I had punched out of work and, you know, went to this bar that I used to drink at, and, you know, I was had a fight with my boyfriend that I was living with. 15 more minutes. Oh, my God, I better back up. Really? Oh, God. Okay, well, recovery is a great story. I mean, that's what we're all here for, right? It is. I mean, I know it is. So, you know, I'll talk to you about recovery because that truly is what it's all about. My last drink. Never went back to work. I was living with a guy, kind of disappeared on him, woke up with a guy that, like I said before, you know, he was probably my father's age, and I just got sick. I just literally said, take me home. I had lost my keys. My mother was at my younger sister's college. It was parents' weekend, and my father had died. You know, I was a no-show all over again. That's who I was. You couldn't depend on me. I tell you one thing, and I did something else. And not that I meant to do that, because I really didn't mean to do that. It's just once I picked up that drink, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. I might have one, I might have 21, I might have 101, you know, whatever. I finally made it home. I sat on my mother's step and cried my eyes out. I didn't think I had a job. I knew the guy I was living with didn't want anything to do with me. And believe me, he wasn't like, you know, a keeper. you know, I cried. And this is the miracle. And this is the moment that everybody that's in here has to have. Because this is what makes it all work. I sat down and I cried. I cried, please, God, help me. Now, I didn't know what kind of help I needed. I didn't know what kind of help I wanted, if I wanted it at all. But it was that moment of desperation that I think Max talked about. And, you know, God hears and answers prayers. I will tell you that. You know, the power of prayer is the most incredible thing in this world. And watch what you pray for, too, because I'll tell you another story. The first time I ever went to a Bill W. dinner, Judy Collins, I'm breaking her anonymity, because back then it was like, wow, you know, I mean, I think I was 2 or 3 years sober, and I saw her up on stage, and I turned to my girlfriend, and I said, you know what, I'm going to be on that stage someday. You know, that's the ego of the alcoholic, and sure enough, you know, 20 years later, or whatever it was, you know, I was chairing the Bill W. dinner, so power of prayer runs deep. That's why they say, watch what you pray for in these rooms, because you're probably going to get it. I found myself on that step crying my eyes out to God, and the miracle, you know, happened, as it does for everybody that's sitting in this room, I'm sure. I didn't know, I don't even know if I knew the word alcoholism. I don't know if I'd ever even heard it before, even though I had an aunt who was 25 years sober. I'm sure they talked about it, but, you know, I had this wall that was built up around me, and, you know, the curtains were drawn and nobody was home. So I didn't really get what was going on in the outside world. I was totally living inside of Barbara. And my mother knew a man who was, actually, he was called my Uncle Johnny, even though he wasn't my uncle. He was a dear friend of my father's. And he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mother said, I think you ought to call your Uncle Johnny up and ask him if you're an alcoholic. And I said, okay, I'll call him up. You know, she wasn't talking to me because I didn't show up. And my mother used to do that to me. She would give me the silent treatment. She would act like I was invisible, like I didn't exist, and nothing used to piss me off more than that. It was like, you know, I just wasn't there. So I went along, you know, okay, call my Uncle Johnny up, and, you know, am I an alcoholic? And he said to me, I can't answer that question for you. You know, why don't you go to an AA meeting? And I'm like, well, what is that? And long story short, you know, this girl comes and picks me up, 90 meetings in 90 days. I was a vegetarian. She stops at McDonald's on the way to the meeting. Did not sit well with me at all. I was already, this is not going to work. You know, I get there, and they're like, 90 meetings in 90 days, and I'm like, yeah, maybe for you, but I have a life to live. You know, like, you think I'm coming to these meetings for 90 meetings, forget it. It's not happening. Not happening. I mean, that's all I could say to this girl that I worked with. You know, Kathy, they want me to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm like, forget it. So not even a week later, she said to me, where are you going tonight, Barbara? I said, you know, to an AA meeting, of course. She's like, well, what happened to, you know, forget about it. You know, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly, and it happened that quick because, you know, it's that language of the heart. It's what you hear all the time, one alcoholic talking to another. Nothing works better than that. You know, David and I have an understanding now that his mother will never have, you know. And I don't feel better than or, you know, smarter than or I don't, you know, it's just because he's an alcoholic. And alcoholics understand alcoholics like nobody else does. So I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and I joined a group and I got a sponsor. And I was told to sit down and shut up. I didn't know a god darn thing about getting sober. All I knew was how to get drunk. I came from a real tough love, you know, group. It was actually, they had many names for it. I can't share them here, but they, you know, they weren't pretty. They were real tough love. And I sat down and I shut up and I learned how to get sober because I did not know. They actually told me to forget about my God, leave him on a shelf, leave him outside, come in here emptied so that they could fill me up and I could learn about this higher power. And I was like, who the hell do you think you are to tell me I don't have God in my life? But you know what? They never lied to me. I didn't have God in my life. I had a God of parochial school. I had a God of my parents. I did not have a God of my own understanding. And that took me so long, a year and a half. I can tell you exactly. It was a year and a half before the lights went on. And I was like, oh, that's what my God's all about, you know? And what a wonderful thing. The 11th step. I'm jumping ahead, but it's always been my most favorite step in AA. I love it, you know, and I put the steps in my life. I started sponsoring people. I became the alternate GSR in my group. You know, I became very active like all of you are, and I will tell you, as I told somebody earlier, you know, it's what gets you. I think it was, who's that pretty blonde that was talking to me? Felicia, when I first got here? We were talking about service, you know, and how it keeps you sober. You know, it truly is what gets you sober, keeps you sober. You're being useful. And you get to meet all these wonderful, wonderful people with all this time, and you want what they have, and you start on that journey, and you become the person that God always intended for you to be that you never were because you drank. I was never the daughter. I was never the sister. I was never the employee. I was never who God wanted me to be. The drink took all of that away from me, all of it. And more. Alcoholism takes. It takes, and it takes, and it takes, and it takes. It takes your education. It takes your relationships. It takes your job, your children, your marriage, your everything, your self-esteem. It just takes. And believe me, it doesn't give up even when you get your little butt in here. It keeps talking to you. Oh, you don't belong here. It wasn't that bad. David, it wasn't that bad, was it? Waking up in the hospital in St. Vincent's by yourself, was that bad enough? I don't think so. I think I jumped the gun. I really think, you know, I think I jumped the gun. You know, I'd rather be nuts than be alcoholic. I'm a Gemini, so it's very fitting for me to be nuts. You know, dual personality. You know, we would rather be anything but alcoholic. You know, we think that it's like that teddy bear. We think it's the only comfort we have in life. We think, oh my God, how am I going to live without it? The thing is, we never lived with it. I lived in a blackout. I had no life experiences before I got here except for bad ones. Misery. They told me to connect the trouble in my life with drinking. And if you get honest enough with yourself when you come in here and you do that, and there's so many people who are in their first 90 days, you have the most beautiful gift that you will ever be given. Ever. God has his hand on your shoulder. He does. You are so blessed. You know, I was 27 years old when I got sober. You know, and I remember saying, well, when I get married, I'm going to drink a case of Cristal. I can be sober today. But when I, you know, God didn't bless me with marriage until I was 20-something years sober. You know, so, again, you know, he knows what he's doing. He totally knows what he's doing. You know, if we would just leave it to him, you know, and step out of the equation, our life would be perfect. We don't need books like The Secret. We don't need Est. We don't need any of that stuff. This is it. If you read that book or listen to it, it's all AA. Write a gratitude list. We all do that. I am so grateful to be sober today. You have no idea. No idea. I am not the person I was when I walked in here. I don't even come close to that person. I don't even like reflecting on those memories. It still makes my skin crawl. 5 more minutes, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. It really does. I can't even tell you. If you're here tonight, somebody also said it before, you know, nothing that comes out of our mouth as alcoholics is original. You know, it's all been shared in these rooms so many times, and we're just like waking up to it. But this is it. You know, you have a gift, and you don't show up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous by accident, you know. People that are normal, you know, and believe me, there is a difference between alcoholics and normal people. You know, again, Kobe's talked about it before. We're chemically different than other people. You know, we will never be normal, no matter how much sobriety we have. I am still the black sheep in my family, although today I'm okay with that. You know, I am okay with that. I have other gifts. My sisters look at me and they say, you are so blessed. And I am, because I have a God of my own understanding in my life, you know, that is like so personal and special to me. And they don't have that. You know, there was a saying, you know, and I'm going to get it wrong because I'm not a good storyteller, but, you know, about how the gates of hell opened up to the alcohol, you know, how we've been to heaven or to hell, or I forget how it goes. It was a good one, though, you know. I'm sure you'll hear somebody share it. So just keep coming back because you will hear it, believe me. But this is the most beautiful program, you know. For the alcoholic, it truly is the only thing that works, you know. You take the booze out of your life. You put the steps in your life. You have that psychic change, that miracle. It's like I said, you know, it's a new pair of glasses. When I got sober, there was a book that came out, A New Pair of Glasses. And, you know, it's a great book. Pick it up. It's an AA read. They talked about how we have a different, you know, vision. We no longer look at the glass half empty when we get sober. We start to look at it as half full. You know, what a concept. You know, we go through life looking at the positive instead of always looking for the negative. Because we have been through hell, and the gates of heaven have opened up for us. I think it goes like that. Anyway, you guys are great. You know, you have a great group here. If you're not a member, join. You know, they could really use a few more people. They don't get enough of a turnout. They just don't get enough of a turnout. My husband, I am blessed with another sober guy. You know, he's got like, how many years? 18? I always forget, you know. Almost 20. Day at a time. That was a gift of sobriety, as you know, many years into it. But my first marriage, so it's very special. And we just bought our first house, which is even more special. But these things aren't guaranteed. You know, don't come here because you're going to get married or you're going to get a new home, because that's not what it's about. It's not about socializing. It's not. It's not about AA clubs or dances. You know, I go to the Wilson House every year, every single year, the month I celebrate. I just celebrated 26 years, October 17th. And I go up there every single year. And it's the best thing in the world because we're with all these couples that are sober. And there's got to be almost 400 years of sobriety on this Sunday night meeting. And there's only like 12 or 15 of us. And it's just, we stay up until 3, 4 in the morning. Everybody shares. And we get caught up with each other, you know, what's happened the year before. And, you know, it's the best thing in the world. But that's not what this is about. I didn't come here to have weekends in Vermont. I came here because I was a drunk and I was dying of the disease, as Kobe talked about, of alcoholism. That's why I came here, because I was Rudolph. I was a misfit. I didn't fit in, and you guys made me feel okay. You took my hand, and you said, sit down and shut up, you know, and, you know, we'll love you until you can love yourself. I can't thank all of you enough for being here. Yeah, it's almost time. And I did it. I can't believe it, and I didn't even really cry. That's progress. Keep coming, Barbara. It's progress. You're a great group. You know, you're special. God loves you. Hold on to your seat, you know, because it's probably the only place in town that'll let you in. But keep coming. AA works. Woo!